Coming up, should all those accused of a serious crime, including the poor, have a lawyer to defend them? Tim O'Brien reports that in many parts of the country, the poor are not getting adequate defense. And the familiar Christmas theme of peace on earth. Kim Lawton looks at how Christians understand that message in today's often chaotic world.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Faith leaders had mixed reactions to the bipartisan budget agreement passed by Congress this week. For many months, religious groups have been urging the government, when slashing the nation's deficit, to protect programs that serve the poor. The Christian lobby Bread for the World and others welcomed the $85 billion deal to limit automatic spending cuts, but said it was only a short-term solution. They also pointed out that the bill still leaves over 1 million Americans without unemployment insurance benefits after the year's end. Meanwhile, at the Vatican, Pope Francis celebrated his 77th birthday. He raised eyebrows earlier in the week with changes to an important Vatican committee that helps to select new bishops. Francis replaced two American cardinals known for their hardline conservative views on social issues. Among the new committee members was Washington, D.C. Cardinal Donald Wuerl, who is seen as more moderate. And in a surprising announcement, a leading gay rights magazine named Pope Francis its Person of the Year. The Advocate said it selected him because of his softer rhetoric on homosexuality, especially compared to that of previous popes. This week, a United Methodist pastor was defrocked after he refused to withdraw his support for same-sex marriage. Reverend Frank Schaefer of Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, had been serving a 30-day suspension after a church jury convicted him of violating church rules by officiating at the wedding of his gay son. He said he felt called to advocate for same-sex couples and plans to appeal the ruling. More trials are expected of other Methodist pastors. In other news, a federal judge in Utah this week struck down parts of an anti-polygamy law in that state, ruling that it's not a crime for polygamous families to live together, even though so-called plural marriages are still illegal. The case involved a polygamous fundamentalist Mormon family from the TLC reality show Sister Wives. The Family Research Council and other traditional family advocates condemned the decision. It's been 50 years since the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that everyone accused of a serious crime, rich or poor, should get an adequate defense. That was the famous Gideon decision. But Tim O'Brien reports that in many parts of the country, the poor are not getting adequate defenses, usually because the state and local governments don't want to pay for them.
Clarence Earl Gideon was a drifter with a history of petty criminal offenses. Arrested in 1961 for burglarizing a pool house in Panama City, Florida, he asked the court to provide him a lawyer. Judge Robert McCrary declined. Under Florida law at the time, only defendants charged with murder get a lawyer at state expense. Gideon, representing himself, was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison, where he studied the law and then drafted this handwritten appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, saying he was denied the effective assistance of counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
A man with money can hire a lawyer to represent him. He'd get a better chance in his trial than I would get without an attorney. I was just common sense. There was no argument to it.
Rarely are such inmate petitions granted, but Gideon had raised an issue that intrigued the court, then under Chief Justice Earl Warren.
Number 155, Clarence Earl Gideon, petitioner, versus H.G. Cochran, Director, Division of Corrections.
And all nine justices agreed, Gideon had it right. Justice Hugo Black writing, "Reason and reflection require us to recognize that in our adversary system of criminal justice, any person hailed into court who is too poor to hire a lawyer cannot be assured a fair trial unless counsel is provided for him. This seems to us to be an obvious truth." Some 2,000 inmates in Florida alone were set free following the court's decision. Gideon himself was retried. The jury found him not guilty after only 1 hour of deliberation. But more important, the decision spawned a nationwide public defender system aimed at ensuring that poor people get adequate legal representation at taxpayer expense if necessary. The task has become daunting, expensive, and the court's decision has become a promise many jurisdictions, particularly in the South, appear unable or unwilling to keep.
The fundamental problem is that governments that are trying to convict and fine and imprison and execute people have no incentive in giving those people lawyers that will defeat those goals.
Stephen Bright is in a position to know. Since 1982, he has run the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, a nonprofit public interest law firm devoted to finding lawyers with the time and talent to represent poor people charged with crime.
Commencement speaker,
when he's not in Atlanta,
Stephen Bright.
You can often find Bright in New Haven, Connecticut, at the Yale Law School, where he has been a guest lecturer for 20 years and one of the law school's most popular instructors. Last year, he was the student's top choice for commencement speaker.
I received a letter just 2 weeks ago. I receive a lot of letters like this, but this happens to be the most recent one, from a woman named Shana Shackelford. She's an African-American woman, and for the last 3 years, she's had arson charges pending against her. The place she was rented was destroyed by fire. She lost everything that she had. She was homeless for some time, but she was able to get a new place to live. And she continued her studies at a community college. After she was charged, she asked for a public defender. Here's her description from what she wrote me of what happened next. "The lawyer I got is an addict, and anyone who sees him can tell that at first glance. He's incompetent, and I did most of the investigation myself. I complained, and 3 months later, another lawyer was added to my case. She constantly encouraged me, a person who has never been charged with any crime of any sort in my life, to take 15 years in prison."
Plead guilty, Shackelford was told, or you'll get 25 years if convicted.
And I said, 25 years. I was like, I've never been in trouble. I didn't do this. He was like, well, you know, it's a lot of evidence against you. And so I was in tears. I didn't know what to do. When you go into the courtroom, it's maybe 200 clients in there. 175 of us were from a public defender. So they usually do us 3 or 4 at a time. And they just, you know, they tell us, okay, we're trying to get a plea deal, plea deal, plea deal. That's all you hear 90% of the cases. Or plea deals. They don't look at what's in your file, nothing. It's just, well, this is the time that's being offered. You can take it or leave it because I really don't have time.
Shackelford says she was on time for every court appearance, although her lawyer seldom even showed up. She spent so much time down at the courthouse, she lost her job. She had no money and no home and was living in the back seat of a car she could no longer pay for. And as she explained in her letter to Stephen Bright,
no money to pay,
desperation
this man, no way to
was setting in.
I have no place to go. I am a certified nurse's aide, but I cannot find employment because this arson charge is hanging over me. I don't know how to fix this, and I have asked to be placed in jail.
I think like in the last couple of weeks before I contacted Mr. Bright, it was just like a really low point. I wasn't working. I mean, I wasn't doing anything. I was just kind of there. So I wanted to get my message out there because I wanted people to know what they'd done. But I didn't want to be here anymore because I kind of felt like it was pointless.
There's nothing left of the small house that Shackelford had rented, which had a history of electrical issues even before she had moved in. And fire inspectors initially traced the source of the fire to a TV set. The case against her turned out to be based largely on an investigation not by law enforcement, but by the insurance company, which had a vested interest in not paying the claim. After 3 years, Bright had the case dismissed in a matter of weeks.
Once we investigated the case and once we talked to the experts, there was no case there. But that had not been done for 3 years.
Unfortunate? Yes. But is it truly representative of how the system works?
I want you to know that there are thousands of people like Chana Shackelford who are crying and pleading and begging for help, and almost all of those cries go unanswered.
And it's not just in Georgia. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Well over 2 million Americans, roughly 7.5% of the population, are incarcerated. Most are poor. A disproportionate number are of color. And many of them did not get the kind of representation the Supreme Court said in Gideon they were entitled to.
In New Orleans, for example, each public defender handles roughly 350 cases a year, more than twice the number recommended by the American Bar Association. The office is short on lawyers and on cash, with taxpayers reluctant to pay for those accused of crime.
We are chronically underfunded. Louisiana is peculiar in how it funds criminal justice generally, but public defense in particular. And that is, we are the only user pay criminal justice system in the country. The fines and fees that come from traffic fines are your biggest revenue source as a public defender.
So when people drive safely and don't get tickets, you lose money.
It hurts us if people drive safely. And also, our system is built on the public defender fee that is charged in every case is only payable if you lose. So it's not lost on our clients at all that we get paid if we lose the case. We actually don't get paid if we win the case.
What we have in Louisiana in our criminal justice system is a humanitarian crisis. And I'm not engaging in hyperbole when I say that. The criminal justice system in Louisiana incarcerates more people per capita than any system in the world. And for poor communities, and especially poor communities of color, it represents a devastating humanitarian crisis.
The Supreme Court made it clear in the Gideon case 50 years ago that the right to counsel is fundamental to anyone accused of a serious crime. Today, in many jurisdictions, that guarantee would appear to work the other way for poor people. Not that they will get the effective assistance of counsel the Constitution requires. The better bet, born out of history, is that they will not. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien at the Supreme Court.
Around the world, Christians are making final preparations for Christmas. In the Philippines, survivors of the catastrophic typhoon Haiyan held a traditional dawn worship service, which began a series of masses in the days leading up to Christmas. Participants said they were trying to hold on to hope in the midst of devastation. In Bethlehem, the traditional birthplace of Jesus, festivities are happening amid renovations at the Church of the Nativity. It's the first restoration of the 4th century structure in 200 years. A full slate of events is scheduled at the Vatican, where the official Christmas tree was lit in St. Peter's Square. Meanwhile, many places are doing brisk last-minute sales of nativity scenes and the ever-popular angel and shepherd figurines. The angels announcing peace on earth to shepherds is an important part of the Nativity story. But what does that mean to Christians today? Kim Lawton takes a look.
Silent night.
It's a major theme in Christmas cards and carols. This is a season of peace.
Sleep in
Really? How do Christians understand the idea of Christmas peace in a world that can seem anything but peaceful? A According to the story in the Gospel of Luke, angels announced the birth of Jesus to shepherds in a nearby field, saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace, goodwill toward men."
Many people want to make Christ's coming about many different things, but we get a picture of it at the very beginning, on the night he was born, that he came for peace.
Nancy Guthrie is a speaker and author who edited a book about Christmas peace. She admits when many Christians look at the world, their communities, and even their own lives, they struggle to figure out what the peace on earth message really means.
It's been 2,000 years since Christ came, and there is no peace, in a sense. We know that there is plenty of war and plenty of conflict. So if that's the kind of peace that was being talked about in the angel's announcement, something has gone very wrong.
Christians have long wrestled over the apparent disconnect. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. preached about it in 1967 in his last Christmas Eve sermon before he was killed.
This Christmas season finds us a rather bewildered human race. We neither have peace within nor peace without.
King went on to preach about the importance of tying peace on earth to the other part of the angel's announcement, goodwill to all. That's a view shared by Reverend Otis Moss III, senior pastor at Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. He says Jesus coming into the world brought a new ethic of caring for others.
Peace requires that we nurture each other, and we live in a very individualized society. And here is a Savior saying that you cannot close yourself off. You cannot live individualized. You have to live this community ethic where you recognize that my freedom is connected to your freedom, that my blessings are connected to your blessings, and that we are deeply interconnected.
Moss says the message of peace can be difficult in a community like his. Over the past year, Chicago has been racked by economic uncertainty and gun violence, especially among young people. Moss and other religious leaders have been leading peace circles, which encourage intense dialogue between groups at odds with each other.
When you start to get to the core of who a person is, all of a sudden, all of the walls begin to crumble down. And we realize that we see each other as brothers and as sisters. And we realize that there is really not a great distance between us. And that's what peace circles do.
Moss finds it significant that in the Christmas story, the angel's peace announcement was given to shepherds.
Shepherds were the lowest of the low, but God says, "I want to speak to you." And then makes this connection. We make it when we talk about the Lord is my shepherd. As soon as we take those who have been forgotten and weave them into the fabric of humanity, we create the kind of shawl and blanket that brings us peace, because no one is cast aside. And that's what God is demanding. And that's how peace comes about.
Nancy Guthrie believes peace on earth is a deeply spiritual notion. She cites the traditional Christian belief that Jesus came to reconcile God and human beings.
Oh, come, let us adore him.
It doesn't mean that we don't have chaotic circumstances, that we're not in the midst of a lot of opposition or difficulty. And yet when we know that there's peace between us and God, then we can live lives of peace, that sense of being at rest, that all is right between us and our Maker.
For Guthrie and her husband David, the Christmas season is a poignant reminder that finding spiritual peace isn't always easy. As they hang the family stockings, there's one for their oldest son, Matt, who's away at college, as well as stockings for their daughter, Hope, and son, Gabriel, who have both died. Hope was born in 1998 with a rare metabolic disorder called Zellweger syndrome. Hope lived just over 6 months. Knowing they carried the risk for the disease, David underwent a vasectomy.
Evidently, it didn't work. And about a year and a half after our daughter Hope died, I gave birth to a son named Gabriel. And Gabriel, too, was with us just a short 6 months, like his sister Hope.
Losing two children to the extremely rare condition sent Guthrie on a spiritual search. She says she ultimately found comfort and peace by embracing what Christians say happened at Christmas, that God came to earth as a human being. She and her husband now lead retreats for other grieving families.
The good news of Christmas is that God hasn't left us on our own in this dark and difficult world. We experience peace, very real peace now, as the God who became flesh dwells with us, even among us.
In his 1967 Christmas Eve sermon, King said despite the fact that sorrow and hardship and violence continue, Christians must hold on to the belief that peace will ultimately prevail.
With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when there will be peace on earth and goodwill toward men. It will be a glorious day.
In the meantime, Moss says he urges people to continue working for peace and watching for how it may already be happening.
For me, it's been looking at this idea of God breaking in, the crazy, daring plan that God had to spend time with humanity. Every day, a new story is born. Every night, a new story is edited. So it's an opportunity to really see the Christmas story from a completely different vantage point every day.
Peace can arrive in unexpected ways and in difficult places, he says, which is what the Christmas story is all about. I'm Kim Lawton.
Peace, hunger, goodwill to men.
Finally, one of the longest-running holiday concerts in the country is the St. Olaf Christmas Festival at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. For more than 100 years, the Lutheran School's elite student choir, the St. Olaf Choir, has earned international accolades. Kim visited for the centennial celebration of the festival and choir.
It's been a century of celebration. For the past 100 years, St. Olaf College, a small Lutheran school in Minnesota, has put on a Christmas concert that has become known and loved around the world. In a variety of ways, nearly a third of St. Olaf's 3,000 students participate in the Christmas festival, which combines more than 600 voices from five campus choirs, including the elite St. Olaf Choir. The repertoire showcases a variety of sacred music. There are classic holiday standards, songs that hark back to the school's Scandinavian heritage, and some from other cultures as well. The program is designed to reflect the essential religious meaning of Christmas. Anton Armstrong conducts the St. Olaf Choir.
It's just not the music, but that we are lifting up a message of hope, a message of faith, a message of understanding, and most of all, a message of love.
The popularity of the Christmas festival has gone global. For decades, it has been broadcast on public radio and public television, and the Armed Forces radio and TV service as well. This centennial concert was also simulcast in movie theaters across the country.
It has been a model for spreading this message of faith at a time that people tend to forget why the season even exists.
When everything falls into place, Armstrong says it's a spiritual experience.
Some people go to prayer and do that. But you know, still small voices and burning bushes don't seem to work with me. You know? But in the minute when that cord locks and we've been struggling with it and it finally works, it's as if, yeah, God is there.
It's an experience he hopes gets transmitted to the audience as well.
When people, when they leave, they have been transformed. They don't know why. But perhaps at 90 minutes of experiencing that the utmost in beautiful music, in powerful and profound texts, will somehow seep into the bodies of those performing and certainly those who are hearing.
I'm Kim Lawton in Northfield, Minnesota.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more music from the St. Olaf Christmas Festival.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.